overview book of Punk's compensation. He got his PhD at MIT and has co-authored a number of papers in this area as well as many other things, and is currently at the Institute for Quantum Information at Caltech.
Thanks, Mary Beth. Okay, so my goal here is to give kind of an overview of why the adiabatic theorem is of interest in the context of quantum computation. Let's get started. So here's kind of an outline of what I'm going to talk about. And you should feel free to stop me at any time if anything's not clear. If I don't manage to make it through everything, I think that's okay. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to start out with some background on what quantum computers are, why they're interesting, and what kind of the mathematical model of quantum mechanical computation is. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about incorporating Hamiltonian dynamics into the model of quantum computation, because the conventional model of quantum computation is one that doesn't make explicit reference to Hamiltonian dynamics. Yet these are the kinds of dynamics we want to talk about when we talk about the adiabatic theorem. Then I'll briefly review the adiabatic theorem in the context of that's relevant for this this quantum algorithm that I'm going to talk about. And then I will describe this idea of using the adiabatic theorem to make an algorithm for optimizing cost functions. This is this algorithm from 2000 by Eddie Farhi, Sam Gutman, Jeffrey Goldstone, and Mike Sipser. And then I'll give some examples of a few cases where this algorithm works or where it doesn't, and then talk briefly about the proposal to apply this algorithm to random instances of satisfiability kinds of problems. And finally, at the end, if there's time, I'll talk a bit about a sense in which adiabatic quantum computation is just as good as any other kind of quantum computation. Okay, so that's the plan. So here's a brief history of how the field of quantum computing got started, how people really got interested in this area. So in the early 1980s, people like Manin and Feynman had the observation that quantum computers, if you had computers that were really built out of quantum mechanical components, then they might be especially suited to simulating quantum mechanical systems. This is a problem which seems to be difficult because even if you just have a finite dimensional quantum system, so say you have n spin half particles, you need 2 to the n complex numbers to represent that system, at least if you want to explicitly write down the wave function. And so, even to just write down what the state is a very intractable thing to do, and never mind evolving it. So, but if you have a quantum system, then of course it has all of these amplitudes, and so you might expect that it would be a good thing to have if you want to simulate quantum systems. So a formal model of quantum computation was introduced by Deutsch in 1985, and he gave the first kind of example of a computational problem, but a very simple computational problem, that you could solve better using a quantum computer than you could using a classical one. And this kind of example was improved with a series of better and better examples through the late 80s and the early 90s with problems where quantum computers did a better and better job of outperforming classical ones. But all of these examples were sort of kind of artificial ones that were constructed explicitly for the purpose of showing something that a quantum computer could do but a classical one could not do as efficiently. And so the real big boost for the field came when Shor in 94 found this quantum algorithm for factoring numbers, which runs in polynomial time. And this is a problem of real interest. It has relevance to cryptography. And so this really showed that quantum computers not only could do things a lot faster, certain things a lot faster than classical computers, but really that they could do interesting things. And at this point, the field sort of exploded. There's been a huge interest in quantum computation since then. So let me say what the formal model of a quantum computer is. So in a quantum computer, you have information stored not in bits, but in quantum bits. And so a quantum bit is nothing but a two-level quantum system where you have two basis states, 0 and 1, corresponding to the two distinguishable values of a classical bit. But you can also have any complex linear superposition of those two states. And then to have a computer, of course, you need to have more than one bit. So maybe you have n qubits. And then those n qubits.
What are alpha and beta?
Oh, sorry. That should be. I guess I changed something. So that should be alpha 0, and that should be alpha. Anyway, it's a normal S.
You said we could ask questions. So
that's great. You're setting a fine example. Okay. All right. So moving on. If we have a system of n of these qubits, then we have a Hilbert space that is just the tensor product of n of these state spaces for an individual qubit. And so we can write an arbitrary state as such. So we have these 2 to the n complex amplitudes, alpha z, one for each of the possible strings of n bits. So a string of n bits just labels one of these basis states, but we can have any linear combination. And again, the state should be normalized. OK, so that's how we represent information. And then what a quantum computer does is it evolves this state using some kind of unitary transformations. And then at the end of the day, you make some kind of measure. So without loss of generality, we can imagine that we prepare the n qubits in the all zero state. We can, you know, we just need some kind of starting state. So let's suppose that we use that one. And then we apply a sequence of unitary transformations which change the state. And to have a notion of efficient computation, we'd like these operations to be simple. So we can imagine, for example, that there are operations that act either on just one or 2 of these qubits at a time, but not more. And this is OK because using such operations, you can build up any unitary operation acting on these n qubits. But having this notion of having it being built up out of parts gives you some idea of whether a unitary operation is easy to implement or hard to implement. So we say that a quantum algorithm, so a sequence of unitary transformations, is easy to implement if it can be represented as using a number of gates, which is polynomial in the number of qubits in the computer. And then finally, we make a measurement to get the result of the computation. And we can imagine, again, without loss of generality, that we make this measurement in the computational basis, meaning we just project onto one of these strings of n bits. All right, so I would say that there are 3 sort of big questions in quantum computing that we would really like to answer. The first of these is how we build a quantum computer. The second is how useful is a quantum computer if it's imperfect. So of course, any quantum computer that we really build won't do exactly what we want, but there may be some small errors, and we would like to be able to neglect these errors. So this is a problem of fault tolerance. And then finally, there's the problem of assuming we solve this problem of fault tolerance and we have a quantum computer that we can effectively assume is perfect, what can we do with it? So this is the problem of coming up with quantum algorithms. This idea of adiabatic quantum computation, I would say, is mostly relevant to this last question. It's a way of coming up with a quantum algorithm. But it might also have some bearing, say, on this question of fault tolerance and maybe even to a lesser degree this issue of implementations. And just to give you an idea of sort of where the field is at, I would say this first question is probably the one about which we know the least. So no one has a quantum computer. People are trying very hard, and there are a lot of different proposals for how you would build a quantum computer. And I would say there's no clear front runner. I mean, there are a lot of ideas, and people are working very hard, but we're not there yet. The second question probably is the one about which we know the most. So there's something called the threshold theorem, which basically says that if you can make your computer good enough, so there's some threshold at which if your errors are small enough, you can effectively make it arbitrarily good. So this is the question which I would say is the most resolved. And then the last question is maybe somewhere in the middle. We know a number of quantum algorithms, but I would say that we know not nearly enough. We would really like to find more algorithms for really interesting computational problems, in part to justify the all the effort that's going into this really hard problem of actually building a quantum computer. Okay. So now I'm going to move on and talk a bit about Hamiltonian dynamics, because this model of a quantum computer that I described to you is one of a sequence of unitary transformations acting on these qubits. But we'd really like to, in this adiabatic algorithm, think about some evolution according to a Hamiltonian. And so how do we put that into this picture? So in the circuit model, what we said was that an operation could be implemented efficiently if it had a short representation in terms of 1 and 2 qubit gates. And we want an analogous notion for Hamiltonian dynamics. One possible idea of what Hamiltonians are easy to implement would be the ones that we can just directly build in our laboratory. So we can build a system that we think is well described by some Hamiltonian H. And this is maybe not a completely appealing idea because, of course, what you can efficiently, what you can realize in a laboratory has to do with what happens to be in your laboratory. But maybe one sensible notion of what kind of Hamiltonians would be easy to build would be ones that are somehow local, have local interactions. So maybe you have a bunch of spins that live on a lattice, And your Hamiltonian is a sum of terms, each of which, you know, couples of parrot spins on the lattice. That might be the kind of thing which is sensible to build. Another notion, another possible notion of what kind of Hamiltonians are, you know, reasonable to use in a quantum computation would be the ones that you can efficiently simulate using quantum circuits, just appeal to the circuit model. And I think, you know, for a lot of reasons, this second notion is a really sensible one and might actually be useful in coming up with quantum algorithms. And one of the nice things about it is that, of course, it includes all of these sort of Hamiltonians that you, at least these sorts of Hamiltonians that ought to be, you know, are sort of, it's sort of sensible to think that you could directly realize them in the lab.
That takes a kind of a difference between what you said in the beginning, which is more discrete
time. Right.
And now you start to be continuous in time.
Right.
So how do you reconcile them?
Okay, well, so maybe this definition will help with that. So what I'm going to give now is a definition of what you mean to simulate a Hamiltonian. And so I'm going to simulate a Hamiltonian using a discrete sequence of unitary gates. And you know, let me get the definition, and maybe this will help with your question. So so let's say that we can simulate a Hamiltonian acting on n qubits if, for any error that we like, that we can make, you know, as small as we like, and any time that we want to simulate the Hamiltonian for, then there's a quantum circuit consisting of, you know, a discrete sequence of unitary gates that approximates the evolution according to that Hamiltonian. So here I'm imagining, you know, a time-independent Hamiltonian, but of course if you wanted to change in time, you could, you know, have it sort of be piecewise constant. But anyway, the basic idea is that, you know, and some kind of time evolution you can imagine simulating by some sequence of unitary gates, in the sense that if you apply that sequence of unitary gates, you get an evolution which is close to the actual one. And for this simulation to be efficient means that the sequence of unitary gates is not too long, so we would like the sequence to consist of a number of gates, which is polynomial in the size of the system, the time that we want to evolve for, and something like the inverse of the error.
Is there a particular norm that you would say is the nicest to use in that situation?
Matrix 2 norms, the biggest eigenvalue. I don't know if it really matters. That's kind of what I have in mind. So, you know, one thing which is nice is that all of these kind of local Hamiltonians are things that you can efficiently simulate. And this was basically observed by Seth Lloyd in 96. And the idea is very simple. The basic idea is just to use this Lie product formula that says that if you want it says that you can express the exponential of a sum of, you know, Hermitian operators as a product of exponentials of the individual ones, if you kind of go back and forth really fast between the different ones, right? Mm-hmm. And if you... What's that?
As an operator statement, it's formalized in any old.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think it's through the Lie. That's right. I mean, so Lloyd's observation was that this is relevant to simulating quantum systems, but yes, it was a simple observation. And you know, the error goes down if you make the number of alterations between these different terms bigger and bigger. So as R gets bigger and bigger, the error gets smaller and smaller. So that's nice. And then I just wanted to mention very briefly another kind of bigger class of Hamiltonians that you can simulate, which you know, might be interesting for adiabatic quantum algorithms. It's maybe not so clear, but I think it's kind of an interesting tool. So the basic idea is that you can simulate Hamiltonians efficiently if they're sparse. So if you write the Hamiltonian out in some basis and it doesn't have too many non-zero entries, then you can simulate it efficiently. And, you know, more concretely, if for any fixed row of that matrix, you can efficiently compute all of the non-zero values in that row. So in particular, it would have to be not too many non-zero values for you to be able to do this. Then you can simulate the evolution according to it efficiently. And the basic idea is that if you consider the graph of non-zero values of the Hamiltonian, so you have a bunch of vertices here corresponding to the basis states and edges corresponding to the non-zero terms, then if you color that graph so that you have, I mean, the coloring means that you have at any given vertex you have at most one edge of a given color incident on that vertex, then basically what happens is that the Hamiltonian falls apart into different pieces. If you look at one given color, so if you look at the blue part of this graph, you have a bunch of edges which you know, don't touch one another. And so the evolution according to, say, just the blue part of the graph is very easy to simulate. And then you could just use this sort of Lie product idea to put the pieces together. And this gives you a bigger class of Hamiltonians that you can simulate. So the basic point is that there are a lot of Hamiltonians that you can write down that you can imagine efficiently simulating on a quantum computer. And now the idea is to try to use these Hamiltonian dynamics to implement some quantum algorithm. Okay. So now I want to say a few words about the adiabatic theorem, which I guess we've already heard about this morning and probably most of you know about, but let me just say a few things just to set the notation. So let's imagine we have a Hamiltonian which varies slowly for some parameter s that varies between 0 and 1. So there's some initial h total of 0, some final h total of 1, and then there's some smooth path between them. And of course, we can decompose the Hamiltonian, you know, just using spectral decomposition, and I want to order the eigenvalues in this way, and I want to imagine that there's a gap between the ground states, the first excited state, just for simplicity. I mean, the ground state is really not degenerate, and there's a gap. Okay, then, you know, so the actual Hamiltonian, I want to define h of t to be this h twiddle of little t over big t. So there's going to be some total runtime big t over which we're going to evolve, and this is a Hamiltonian which gets smoother and smoother as t gets bigger and bigger. So we evolve for a longer and longer time, we stretch this out, and the evolution gets smoother and smoother. And then what the adiabatic theorem says is that as we take this big t to infinity under suitable conditions, the overlap between the state when we evolve for time t and the final ground state, so the ground state of this h twiddle of 1, that overlap goes to 1. But what we really want to know for this algorithm is, of course, you know, how does it go to 1? So if we make t very large, we would expect that the state after evolving for time t would be close to the final ground state, but the question is, how large does it have to be? We know that the total runtime required for adiabaticity depends on what the spectrum of the Hamiltonian looks like, and in particular, it depends a lot on the gap. So I'm just going to define the gap to be delta of s, so just the gap between the ground and first excited state. I'm going to let delta be the minimum value of the gap for all values of s. And then, okay, so there are some kind of rough estimates. For example, if you look in quantum mechanics textbooks, like the one by Messiah, then you know, you'll see some condition. Well, maybe it's not written exactly there, but you can get out of it some condition that says that the time should be much bigger than something that goes like 1 over the gap squared, where there's some other factor that depends on how fast the Hamiltonian changes. And I guess, you know, many people here are well aware that you can actually make rigorous statements about how big the time has to be. And here's an example of a statement like that, which I extracted from this book by Teufel with, you know, just some small manipulations on top of it. But anyway, this is the kind of adiabatic theorem that we would like to have, you know, for these adiabatic algorithms. So we want to know that if we make the time bigger than some value, that the final state will be close to the ground state in some sense. And this theorem shows kind of how it depends on the gap, or at least a sufficient condition for the state to be close to the final ground state. In this statement, it goes like 1 over the gap cubed. Essentially, I mean, for many problems, this will be the term that dominates. But the point is, you know, you can make some kind of rigorous statement under which, if you know the gap is not too small and the time is sufficiently big compared to that time, compared to that energy scale, then you'll be close to the ground state when you finish the evolution. Okay. So what kinds of problems could we imagine solving using this adiabatic evolution? The idea here is to come up with a quantum algorithm which is inspired by adiabatic evolution. So let's imagine that we have a problem of minimizing a cost function. So suppose we have a function that maps strings of n bits into, let's say, positive integers. Then a question you could ask about such a function is there a value of the input z, is there a string of n bits, that when you evaluate this cost function on that string, you get 0? Or alternatively, you could ask kind of a minimization problem. You know, what's the value of the string that minimizes, or what's a value of the string that minimizes that cost function? So an example of a kind of problem like this that's very interesting in computer science is this problem 3-sat. This is the specific case of k-sat, where k equals 3. So you can imagine how it's generalized from here. But You know, three-set is a problem where you have a bunch of clauses which are anded together. So it's a conjunction of clauses where each of the individual clauses is a disjunction, an OR of three values. So you have three bits. So for example, here we have Z1 or Z2 or not Z3. So you, if you like, you can negate some of the values. And then you have a conjunction of a whole bunch of these clauses. So each clause involves three bits, and you can have potentially as many clauses as you like. Well, I guess if you had a very large number of clauses, they would start to become redundant. But anyway, you can have a lot of clauses. So,
can I ask a
question?
Yeah. Can the clause only contain those kinds of disjunctions, or can it contain other conditions like Z1 equals Z2?
Well, so I guess in what most computer scientists would call K-set, or in this case, three-set, it has to be in this form. This is called conjunctive normal form. So, I mean, you could imagine another kind of satisfiability problem. Imagine many other kinds of satisfiability problems where the clauses had different forms. And in fact, I'm going to consider some problems like that easier, like that later. So you could imagine, you know, clauses, you know, sort of generalized clauses that said, you know, Z1 equals Z2 is not equal to Z3. Or something. But that would be a different problem. This is just an example.
So the Z's here are actually evaluating whether the bit is 0 or 1 and just reporting it back?
Yeah, that's right. So they're boolean, you think of the bits as Boolean values. So 0 is false and 1 is true. Okay, so so we can think about this, the problem of, so we have this formula, and then what's the problem? The problem is the assignment of the bits so that the formula is true? So it, can we choose values for Z1 through Zn so that this formula evaluates to true? So a way of figuring out whether you can evaluate the formula to true for some input is by coming up with a cost function like this. So we have a cost function which is a sum of costs for the individual clauses. And the cost of a given clause on an input Z is just 0 if the clause is satisfied by that string. So it, in this case, it depends only on three of the bits. Or the cost is 1 if the clause is not satisfied. So if there's an input string 0 for which the total cost is 0, it must mean that all of the clauses are satisfied. So that means that the formula is satisfiable. So it evaluates to true on some input. Or alternatively, you know, the value of Z that minimizes this cost function would be the one that sort of is the least bad, the one that violates the smallest number of clauses. That might also be an interesting thing to think about. So this problem is very hard. This problem is NP-complete, which means that there are a lot of problems in computer science that if you could solve this problem, you could solve all those other ones. And it's not believed that you can solve this problem efficiently. So, you know, if you ask the computer scientist on the street, he would say, probably there's not a polynomial time algorithm for this problem. But you know, it's an interesting problem to solve. But you know, we could also, this is just an example. There are a lot of other kinds of problems that we could state in this framework where we have some kind of a cost function. And you know, some of those other problems would be just as hard as this problem. But you know, you could also state some problems that would be easier. So you should think of this as kind of a general framework for optimization problems.
Is it believed or known that it is NP-complete?
No, the three set is NP-complete. So what's not known is whether it's actually hard, right? So, yeah. So it's strongly believed that it's hard. You know, this is the famous question: is P equal to NP, right? So if there's a polynomial time algorithm for this problem, then P is equal to NP. There was a $1 million prize for this question. Okay. All right. So here's a description of the quantum algorithm, which is inspired by this. Adiabatic theorem for solving problems like satisfiability or any kind of problem with minimizing the cost function. So the idea is the following. So you have some problem Hamiltonian which essentially encodes the problem. So that problem Hamiltonian is always just going to be a Hamiltonian which is diagonal in this computational basis, its basis of bit strings, and the value on the diagonal for the bit string Z is just the cost of that bit string. So clearly, if you could find the ground state of this Hamiltonian, you would solve the problem. You would have found the value Z that minimized the cost. Right? That's all the ground state is. So the idea is to get into that ground state adiabatically, by adiabatic evolution. So what we're going to do is we're going to define a beginning Hamiltonian whose ground state is easy to create. And there are a lot of, I mean, You know, you could write down any Hamiltonian you like, but one kind of Hamiltonian that might make sense would be basically a magnetic field in the, I guess, minus x direction. So this is some kind of Hamiltonian whose ground state would be a superposition of all the possible extremes equal coefficients. But anyway, you know, you pick some Hamiltonian whose ground state is easy to construct. And then what we're going to do is we're going to start in the ground state of this initial Hamiltonian and slowly change the Hamiltonian using some smooth interpolation h twiddle of s that goes from hb to hp as we take s from 0. But we're going to evolve with this kind of a Hamiltonian with, you know, h of t being h twiddle of little t over big t, as I said in the, you know, when I discussed the adiabatic theorem earlier. And we're going to choose the total runtime t so that the evolution is nearly adiabatic. So what's going to happen is we start in the ground state of hb, and by slowly changing the Hamiltonian, we gradually move ourselves into the ground state of hp, thereby solving the problem.
Could you repeat again what you said about ground state of hb?
Oh, okay, right. So in this particular case, if we choose this Hamiltonian, then its ground state is just a linear combination of all the z's with equal coefficients, right? So it's just
it's all zeros in the sigma x basis. So hb is in the sigma x basis. So it's
maybe 5,000.
Yeah. So. Right, and if we have minus this, then the eigenvector 1, 1 has eigenvalue minus 1. So that's, if you like, the ground state.
You take a product state of those.
You take a product state of those, and that will be the ground state of this Hamilton.
Well, the z up there refers to the sigma of z rather than sigma of x.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. Elementary questions.
But
the z and the less than hp.
That's right. That's why I write z there. Yeah.
No, that's fine.
How do I know that there are no level crossings? Well, I mean, so generically, I mean, if you make these things, so okay. If you make a really bad choice, there may be level crossings. So suppose we chose HB to be, you know, diagonal in the computational basis, right? Then probably there will be level crossings. But, you know, generically, if you pick something like this, where this is diagonal in the computational basis and this is diagonal in the sigma x basis, then, I mean, generically, there won't be a level crossing.
You mean that there's codimension 1?
Yeah, that's right. So kind of codimension. Yeah, in fact, so. So there are some cases in which you can actually prove, actually not only that there's no level crossing, but that the smallest gap could be at worst like doubly exponentially small or something like that. Under some kind of
one is
in N, yeah. But I mean, you know, this is a general setup, and you know, to figure out whether it works or not, you're going to have to know something about the gap. So first of all, you're going to have to know that there is a gap, and then you're going to have to know that it's big, and so that's. You know, what's going to be hard, though, is not knowing that there is a gap, but knowing that it's big. Okay. All right. So the problem is, how do you choose this runtime? How big is that going to have to be so that the evolution is nearly adiabatic? If this runtime has to be very large, then that's no good, because then we have an algorithm which takes a very long time. But if the runtime does not have to be too big, then we have an efficient algorithm. And the thing which matters is really the gap. So in these adiabatic theorems, you have things that depend on how fast the Hamiltonian changes, and you also have the gap appearing. But the thing which really matters is typically the gap. So if we just look at, for example, this kind of rough estimate that says the time estimate is much bigger than some function of how fast the Hamiltonian changes divided by the square of the gap, then if we choose, for example, this simple linear interpolation between hb and hp, this would generalize, I think, to any kind of smooth interpolation between them. So the derivative of this h twiddle of s is just hp minus hb. And so its norm is no bigger than the norms of these individual Hamiltonians, hb and hp, which have to be not too big if we want this evolution to be efficiently singulable, or if we want it to be kind of a reasonable thing to realize in the lab. So that means that, this term in the numerator is not something we really have to worry about. And the real question is, how big is the gap? So if the gap is big, then the algorithm will be efficient. And for it to be big, I mean, it's even OK if the gap goes to zero as the number of bits goes to infinity. So if it went to zero, like 1 over some polynomial in n, so if it went like 1 over n or 1 over n squared, we would still say we had an efficient quantum algorithm, because that just means the time is going to have to be proportional to n or n squared, or whatever that polynomial in n is. But what's bad is, of course, if the gap goes to zero very fast. So if it goes like 1 over an exponential in n, something like that, then we would say that we have an inefficient quantum algorithm.
For the efficiency, it doesn't really matter if the time goes like 1 over the gap squared or 1 over the gap cubed.
That's right. Polynomial. That's right. Yeah. So if we're only interested in the time up to some polynomial, this issue of whether it's 1 over the gap squared or 1 over the gap cubed, or it could be 1 over the gap to the 10th, you know, it wouldn't matter. We would still say it was efficient. There's an example I'm going to talk about in a moment, though, where it actually doesn't. So now I'm going to give some examples of cases where this algorithm works, and also an example where it doesn't. So the first example I want to give is, I think, the only example of a case where it's known that an adiabatic algorithm does something that no classical algorithm can do. And this is the problem of unstructured search. So this is the problem, basically, of finding a needle in a haystack. So we're going to consider the case where we have a haystack of n items, and there's exactly one needle. And that needle is called w. So we have a function h of z, which is 0, only when z is equal to w, but it's 1 everywhere else. So I'm expressing this unstructured search problem kind of as one of these minimization problems. Now, I guess I said before that we were always going to think about our computers being comprised of bits. Here it actually doesn't matter. We could imagine that we have just n items. I mean, n could be a power of 2, but we could have a perfectly sensible discussion even if it wasn't a power of 2. So I'm just going to leave it as capital N. And this is a problem which has been studied a lot in quantum computation in terms of a model of query complexity. And the idea here is that, you know, what matters for this problem is how many times you have to query this function to determine the value of w. So the problem is to find w, and we want to do it using as few queries to this function as possible. So classically, basically, you need to query this thing a number of times proportional to n. It's not hard to see that there's really not, you know, really anything better that you can do than like querying all of the z's, you know, in succession, or maybe in some random order. And no matter what you do, you're going to have to query it about n times. But quantum mechanically, you can actually do better than that. Maybe not dramatically better than that, not exponentially better than that, but you can do quadratically better than that. So you can find this marked item w in a number of queries, which is on the order of square root of n. This was discovered by Grover in 96. And in the quantum context, what do I mean by queries of this function? Well, I mean, you have to be able to query this function in superposition for different inputs, and you have to be able to query it reversibly. So in other words, you have access to some kind of unitary transformation that does this, which basically lets you compute this function. And you could ask if you could do better than this, but the answer is no, you can't do better than this. So this was actually proved even before the algorithm was discovered, despite these publication dates. But anyway, you really need on the order of square root of n queries.
What does this mean? There's a direct sum h of z.
Oh, so this is, sorry, this is just addition modulo 2. So these are bits. So it's just addition. If you want to query this function, probably what you do is you put a 0 in here, and then you get h of z here. But we have to define a unitary operation. So we want to define it also when a is 1. And so, well, it has to be.
If n is a power, if n is 2 to the k, then the square root of n is 2 to the k over 2. It doesn't seem to be much.
Yeah, okay. So it's not a dramatic improvement, but it's an improvement, right? So I mean, so classically you can prove that you can't do any better than n. And quantum mechanically you can do better. I mean, that's what's surprising about this.
Well, it could be if you had a finite size problem, you know, that took a million snaps, there could be a big advantage to being able to evaluate it in the thousands.
Yeah. So basically, what this lets you do is it lets you speed up brute force search. I mean, that's maybe how you should think about it.
But I wanted to just say one other thing about that. It's also an example where you can prove that a quantum computer can do something that a classical computer cannot do.
That's right.
So it establishes that that result establishes very dramatically that quantum computation is more powerful than classical computation. Because the Shor algorithm, someone may discover classically a polynomial time algorithm, but no one is going to be able to do this thing classically with less than any steps.
Right.
So this is a huge result in the foundation of quantum.
Well, Simon's
algorithm, right?
Well, because if P equals NP, then someone might discover a classical algorithm. In any actual setting in which one would use a search algorithm, you don't really have a black box.
Well, fair enough. I was saying there are black boxes.
Right. So
I'm sorry.
But wasn't Simon's algorithm something that was provably exponential?
That's also an oral.
Well, if you accept this black box model, then it's provably exponential. But in real life, there aren't really black boxes. There are certain subroutines or algorithms. You can always open these boxes.
So maybe let me just summarize. So there's some abstract model in which you can prove that there's something that you could do better with a quantum computer than a classical one, and it may not be the same as the model that you are really interested in, but nevertheless it's interesting because it establishes, at least in some sense, that there's this separation. Okay, but anyway, this is all stuff that was done in this conventional quantum computing paradigm of unitary operations, and now I want to say how you can put this into the adiabatic setting. And actually still get this speed up using adiabatic optimization, which is at least somewhat encouraging for this idea. Okay, so if we have this cost function, which is just zero on one die of z and one everywhere else, then what this problem Hamiltonian is going to be is just a projector onto the subspace orthogonal to this marked item W. Okay, so it's just one minus projector onto W. And then a sensible kind of thing to do if we want to solve this problem is to start in a state which is like a linear combination of all the possible answers. I mean, there's some kind of permutation symmetry, so this is in some sense the only reasonable state to start in. And then a reasonable Hamiltonian to use is the projector onto the subspace orthogonal to S as the beginning Hamiltonian, because this is something which has as its ground state this uniform superposition S, and all the other states have energy 1. So now if we just linearly interpolate between these two Hamiltonians, what happens? Okay. Well, here's a plot of the gas as a function of S. So what happens is that for values of S very close to a half, there's a very small gap. It goes like 1 over the square root of n. And so this is bad, because if we have one of these, if we believe that the time that we need to run the algorithm for goes like 1 over the square of the gap, then that's like n, which is not as good as we really want it to do. So that seems discouraging. But then what you can do is realize that the region of S, so the values of S for which the gap is very small, is actually very narrow. So you can do something clever, which is that you can choose a way of interpolating from HB to HP where you change the Hamiltonian very slowly for values of S close to a half. And this was discovered by independently by Jeremy Rouen, who's here in the audience, and Nicholas Cerf, and then Dan Mosca, who I guess I'll just walk in. Yeah, there he is. And Umesh Bazarani. Anyway, so the point is that by choosing carefully choosing the schedule of interpolation from S equals 0 to S equals 1, where you move very slowly for values of S near a half, you can actually make an algorithm that will stay in the ground state running for a time that's proportional to the square root of n.
So you mean faster? I don't understand.
So if S is close to a half, so for values of S close to a half, how do I say it? I mean, you change the Hamiltonian very slowly when S is close to a half. So,
you want something that goes up and then is constant for a while, then goes up.
Oh, did I plot? Maybe I switched the axes or something when I made the plot. But forget about the plot. Anyway, the point is. The point is that you want to change. I mean, I think this is really the right thing, right?
So it's not S of t, but if you plot t of s, then
yeah, that's it. Is that clear? maybe we can talk about it afterwards. But you know, physically, what you should do is for values of s close to a half, you should be changing the Hamiltonian slope.
Let's forget it.
That's
sideways. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So here's another example, which is maybe more in line with the idea of solving satisfiability problems. So this is something which in physics is called the transversizing model, but we can think of it as a computational problem where we have spins that want to agree. So here we have a clause for a pair of neighboring spins on a ring, where the value of the energy for those neighboring spins is going to be zero if the spins are pointing in the same direction. So if we have zero, zero for the values of those spins, or it'll be also zero if it's one, one, but it'll be one if it's one of the two orthogonal states. So we have a bunch of bits around the ring that we want to all be the same. And it's in some sense a trivial computational problem because the answer is just all spins are zero or all spins are one. There's not really a problem here.
Why is there a half in the Hamiltonian?
Why is there a half? Oh, I just did that so that this is either zero or one. The value is either zero or one. If there wasn't it.
These are the power matrices.
Well, maybe the half should be.
It shouldn't be.
Maybe the half should be out front. No, I guess I meant the half to be out front, right? Because here the eigenvalues will be. If you don't have, should have been more careful making these slides. If the half isn't there, then the eigenvalues for the individual terms will be zero or two. So if you want them to be zero or one, the half should be up front.
What do you mean by quantum space combination? Because easing modeling is basically classical.
There's a transverse field. Yeah, so I'll get there in a moment. So what we want to do is we want to get into the ground state of this Hamiltonian, which will solve this problem, the problem in quotes, of getting all the spins to agree. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to choose the initial Hamiltonian to be this transverse field, pointing in the x direction. So that has this similar kind of ground state that we've seen before, which is a uniform superposition of all possible solutions. And we're going to linearly interpolate between these two Hamiltonians like this. So the question of how slowly you have to evolve has to do with what is the gap.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just missing one point. Your system is one-dimensional. Right?
Yes.
And the one-dimensional Heisenberg model has no phase transition.
So this is a this is not the Heisenberg model, though.
Okay. I mean, every x, y, z model. Has no phase transition, so
this one does.
You're talking about phase transition in temperature, right? He's at zero temperature, and what's inducing what he does? He's at zero temperature, and there's a transverse magnetic field, and he's asking when he turns off that transverse magnetic field, whether there's phase transition. And zero temperature systems studied like this, that's called quantum phase transition. Because the model is really quantum mechanical, you're right. If you just have H and A, and the temperature is a classical model. But when he has that transverse field, he's in the quantum domain.
That's right.
And that's what he wants to know.
It's the phase transition is just referring to having two different grounds.
Basically, the ground state. So what happens is the ground state has a different character for values of s smaller or bigger than some critical value. At that critical value is the place where the gap is the smallest. And if you have values of s which are small, then the ground state basically looks like the ground state of this initial Hamiltonian. So it's a bunch of spins pointing in the x direction. And if you have values of s which are bigger than that critical value, then the ground state looks like this kind of GZ state.
Oh, okay. This is
So that was the point of this comment. But anyway, the punchline for this example is that the gap goes like 1 over the number of spins. And that's you know, a gap which is going to zero and then goes to infinity, but in an inverse polynomial way. So that means that the time you have to evolve for to stay in the ground state is not so big. It's a polynomial in n. So we would say this is a case where the algorithm works efficiently.
Let me make another comment that I think is worth pointing out for people who aren't doing quantum computing. You keep emphasizing that you're starting the initial Hamiltonian in a superposition of the possible solutions in the final Hamiltonian. But you're also doing the reverse. Whatever the ground state is an evenly weighted superposition of all of the eigenstates of the initial Hamiltonian.
With some phases.
With some phases, but you know the amplitudes are all the same.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So your adiabatic transition, unlike what typically occurs in molecular atomic systems, where you're looking at a few low main contribution comes from the low inclined states. Mm-hmm. Over this integral, all of the excited states of the initial Hamiltonian contribute just as much as the ground state.
I guess by the end.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go on to the next example now. But the reason I wanted to mention that you can think about this as a quantum phase transition is kind of to explain what goes wrong in the next example. So was that clear? I guess I explained this. So you have these two different phases where basically the ground state looks like two different kinds of things.
But is my impression correct that here you use the terminology for a quantum phase transition, which is not the canonical one of quantum statistical mechanics?
I think this is becoming standard terminology. So for example, there's a book called Quantum Phase Transitions by a guy named Sashdev, and this is a big area of research now
there is a terminology which is well established since decades of years.
Yeah.
What is the quantum phase transition? It's the quantum statistical mechanics.
Yeah.
And my impression is that this is an interesting other issue, but it is not the same.
It's basic. The temperature is not the only thermodynamic. Also for the Heisenberg model, you have infinitely many irreducible representations in the ground state.
This is not considered to be a
basis.
Yes.
We do have a lot of time for discussion, so maybe we should save this for the discussions that will end or continue.
All right, so let me continue to this next example. So I want to give an example of a case where the algorithm doesn't work, and that's an example which is very similar to this example of the Ising model on a ring with a transverse field, but where the couplings are just not the same everywhere. So in this example, we have exactly, and again, I got the factor of 2 wrong, so this factor of 2 should be up front. But anyway, what we have is a bunch of spins on a ring, and we have bonds where they want to agree. But now what we do is we choose at random, we just flip a coin to decide for any given bond whether it should have strength 1 or 2. So you could think about this as adding one of these logical clauses in once or adding the same clause in twice. And we just choose this at random for every one of these n clauses. I guess this should be a little n also. And then if we again use a transverse field and we linearly interpolate from the beginning to the final Hamiltonian, then what happens is that typically the gap will scale like e to the minus, not n, won't be exponentially small in n, but it'll be exponentially small in the square root of n.
Almost surely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for typical choices of these random values. Or, in fact, you can make explicit choices of the J's so that it certainly will scale like this. And, the basic idea about why this happens is the following. So if we choose these bonds at random, then, of course, typically we'll have, a bunch of, what's most likely to happen is that we'll have short segments of 1s and short segments of 2s. But since the chain is very large, there will be some rare events which are unlikely, but will happen somewhere in the chain with reasonable probability, where we have long strings of these stronger bonds separated by long strings of the weaker bonds. And then what happens is, as we change this value of s, the cases where, in these regions where the where the bonds are stronger, the state will want to become like the state of the final, the ground state of the final Hamiltonian sooner than it does in these intermediate regions. And these separated regions where we have these big GHG state type states in the state while we're evolving will not get to talk to each other. And so you'll have to evolve really very, very slowly to get these regions to talk to one another and get the overall ground state to be the correct thing, which is the superposition of all zeros plus all ones. That's the basic idea. And so, you know, Fisher was able to analyze this using some kind of a normalization group analysis. And there was a more rigorous treatment in a recent stock paper by Ben Reichardt, who's also here, for a particular realization of these values, where they're not chosen at random, but you have big regions. I mean, you just choose there to be big regions of bonds with strength 1 and then bonds with strength 2. You can analyze it using methods very similar to the methods you use to analyze the case where, you know, the case where all the bonds are equal strength, but it's harder because you have different strengths. OK, so now I wanted to say a few words about what other kinds of problems you might like to try to solve with the adiabatic algorithm, but where a lot less is known. So one proposal which has been made by Eddie and other people is to try to use their adiabatic algorithm to solve random instances of satisfiability problems. So these problems, in the worst case, are very hard. In theory, you know, these problems are often NP complete. But if we choose the instances at random from some distribution, then maybe we have a chance of trying to solve these instances. So if we consider an example of one of these problems, like the 3-sat problem that I mentioned earlier, or another example that has gotten a lot of attention is this problem called exact cover, and we choose some fixed ratio of the number of clauses to the number of bits, but otherwise we choose the instance just completely at random, then there's an interesting kind of, again, phase transition phenomenon that occurs, but completely unrelated to the other one. So what happens is that if we have very few clauses compared to the number of bits, then the problem will typically be under-constrained, and there'll be a lot of solutions, and it'll be easy to find. But if you have a lot of clauses, then the problem will typically be over-constrained, and there won't be any solutions, and in fact, it'll be easy to find a contradiction in the formula that shows you that there's no solution. So in fact, in many of these problems, you can rigorously prove that in the limit of a large instance, there's a sharp transition at some value of the ratio of the number of clauses to the number of bits, where the instance changes, where typical instances change from being satisfiable to being unsatisfiable with high probability. And you might expect that the hardest instances of problems like this would be problems where the ratio of the number of clauses to the number of bits is close to that critical value, because these are the ones that are sort of the most balanced between these under-constrained and over-constrained cases.
Where does random come into this?
So what we're doing is we're picking the instances at random with a fixed ratio of the number of clauses to the number of bits. And we like an algorithm that typically works, you know, that works with high probability for such an instance. So is the question why we're doing that?
So these are just quantum problems, the type that you were looking at before.
Well, they're classical. In fact, they're classical problems, and then we're going to try to use this quantum algorithm to solve them. But they're just formulas. Let's say they're 3-sat formulas. So they're a bunch of conjunctions of disjunctions of three variables, and the question is there some assignment of those variables that satisfies the instance? It's just a classical problem. You have some logical formula, and you want to know if it can be satisfied. And you're choosing formulas at random from some particular distribution.
Wait, you're choosing them for random purposes of testing the algorithm.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you actually want to solve such instances.
But I mean, it doesn't have to be random. I mean, somebody could walk in the door and come up to you and say, okay.
Yes, yes. The algorithm is perfectly defined for any instance. Yes. But the question which a lot of people have been interested in is, does the algorithm work on average if you choose the instances from yes. some kind of a distribution?
Yes.
Something still not clear?
So you're asking whether the guy who wanders in with a typical problem, whether he's likely to get the answer right or not.
Yeah.
So
you're not worried about worst case performance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe one reason to do this is that you really believe that the problem is intractable in the worst case. I mean, this is in fact what people believe for many of these problems. And you would like to find something a quantum computer can do that hopefully a classical computer can't do. So maybe this is a natural candidate.
Well, you're considering random differences. I mean, isn't it believed that, that there's a critical ratio that gives you the worst cases?
Some people believe that, yes. I mean, it's controversial.
Yeah.
People also are very interested in classical algorithms for these kinds of problems. And you know, one thing which is, of course, conceivable is that there's a quantum algorithm for these problems, but actually it's a classical one. But I don't want to get into that. But anyway, you could ask, how does the adiabatic algorithm perform for typical instances drawn from this kind of a distribution? And it apparently is very hard to analyze such a problem. But one thing you can do is numerical simulation. So this is some data from a science paper by Eddie and some of the co-authors, where they generated instances at random, not exactly in this way, but they chose them to be random with unique satisfying assignments, which is some kind of distribution that you might think is similar to this one. Maybe it's even the same in the limit, I'm not sure, as the distribution where you fix the critical ratio of clauses to bits. But anyway, they chose some kind of random, some instances at random that you might expect would be hard, and then by simulating the adiabatic algorithm, they did figure out how long for those instances you would have to run the algorithm to get a success probability of 1/8, which is reasonably big for big instances. And what they found was that for the small instances that they were able to simulate, that you didn't have to run the algorithm very long, and in fact there seemed to be roughly some kind of quadratic dependence on time for quadratic dependence on the number of bits in the instance for the time you would have to run the algorithm for it to get the probability. Of course you can't conclude anything from this about how well the algorithm works on arbitrarily large instances, but it's very difficult to even get more data to support the data you already have, because simulating this adiabatic algorithm is a problem of simulating a quantum system, which seems to be very difficult for a classical computer. If we have quantum computers, then we could extend this data a lot further. But alas, we don't. It's an interesting question, what's going to happen if you consider large instances of this problem, and a lot of people are thinking about this, but I would say the situation is very much unresolved.
What happens if you, instead of chaperoning 1/8, you put a quarter or 1/16 or something
different? I don't think it really changes things. Yeah, I don't know. Have you looked in detail at what happens to the scaling if you change that number?
No, because what happened eventually is we stopped running times and we actually started estimating gaps.
Right.
So we made a little shift in our program, in our approach. We discovered that we could do gaps more easily than doing time. So we then collected data, which for some reason we never published. I was thinking about why, but I couldn't figure out why we were published. Anyway, we have a lot of data on gaps. It's very similar, in the sense that you can fit the gap, the typical gap, by a polygon rule, but it's not compelling.
From a computational point of view, any kind of constant probability is just as good as any other, because if you repeat the algorithm, some large number of times, then
even if the probability is going down 1/n.
Yeah, that would be fine too. But, I think what they did was they just picked something so that they could generate data.
Right.
Okay. So I wanted to say just a few words about this idea of simulating arbitrary quantum computation adiabatically. And I'm not really going to give it any of the details, so let me just go through it kind of quickly, because this is another thing which is, I think, some evidence that the adiabatic algorithm that the idea of adiabatic quantum computation might be a powerful. So what the idea is that if you consider adiabatically evolving a quantum system, and even if you restrict to having linear interpolation between your beginning and ending Hamiltonians, and you make those Hamiltonians be local, so you make things reasonably simple, nevertheless you can simulate an arbitrary quantum computation in this way. And the idea is based on a Hamiltonian that Feynman wrote down as sort of the Hamiltonian of a Hamiltonian that could be used to simulate arbitrary computations. in a paper in 1985. And the basic idea of this Hamiltonian is that it has two registers, one of which represents the data in the computer, and one of which represents a clock. And if you increment the value of the clock from j to j plus 1, then you apply a unitary operation to the system. And of course, since the Hamiltonian has to be Hermitian, there has to be another term where you can go the other way and undo the unitary operation. But you know, if you manage to go forward, then what happens is you apply a sequence of unitary transformations, you know, thereby performing a computation. OK, so you know, the basic idea of this construction is to use this as, or minus this as the problem Hamiltonian, which is a Hamiltonian that will have as its ground state sort of a superposition over histories of the computation. So in this clock register, you have a value j. And if in this clock register you have a value j, then in the first register, you have the state that you would get by doing the first j steps of the computation. That's the ground state of this Hamiltonian. And if you could make this state, it's effectively as good as being able to do the computation, because if the computation is not very long, so if k is not very big, then if you just measure this register, you have a reasonably high probability of actually getting the final value k. And that probability only goes like 1 over k. And so if you get that state, then in this first register, you have the state that you were trying to produce. So the basic idea is you make some kind of beginning Hamiltonian that enforces the correct initial state, and you add some energy penalties to keep you in an appropriate subspace. You do some kind of engineering, and then you can write down something where you can prove that the gap is not too small, so evolution for a polynomial time lets you simulate an arbitrary quantum computation. Okay, so the only thing I want to say about this, I mean, this is very interesting, and you know, suggests that you know, adiabatic evolution can do, I mean, it shows that adiabatic evolution can, in a sense, do arbitrary quantum computation. But while it's an adiabatic algorithm, it's not of a form of the adiabatic optimization algorithm that I was talking about before. I mean, this H is not diagonal on the computational basis. This procedure is not optimizing a cost function. So, you know, while this is encouraging, you know, it of course, you know, doesn't show that you can solve you can perform an arbitrary quantum computation as an optimization problem. And so it actually doesn't have a lot of bearing on this question of how well does the algorithm work for, you know, say, typical instances of satisfiability problems. I mean, it has nothing to say.
You think it does say it'll be hard to prove it won't work?
Well, maybe suggests that, yeah.
Sue is going to talk about this on Saturday.
OK, great. OK, so that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Are there any more questions?
I have a basic kind of fuzzy question, I think, and that is, it's always stuck in my head when I'm thinking about adiabatic quantum computing. That probably means I can learn things very quickly, but anyways, having a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the answer to the problem here, it's not like as hard as solving the problem or something to come up with a Hamiltonian that has the...
I mean, to come up with a Hamiltonian that has that ground state is certainly not, right? I mean, basically, if you can compute the cost of a given string, then you can figure out this Hamiltonian, right? Yeah. I mean, you can
implement it.
So I gave this description of what Hamiltonians you can efficiently simulate, and this Hamiltonian is of that form. So if you have say, a satisfiability problem where you have a cost function, which is a sum of costs for individual clauses, then what you have is a local Hamiltonian, and local Hamiltonians are ones that you can efficiently simulate. And even if it's not, you know, expressed in terms of clauses, but it's just some diagonal Hamiltonian where you can compute the diagonal entries, I mean, in particular, it's sparse, it's very sparse, it's diagonal. And so it's one of these sparse Hamiltonians. I mean, in fact, you don't need all of this graph calling machinery. You can just simulate it. So yeah, certainly for any of these diagonal Hamiltonians where the values on the diagonal are just the costs, if you can compute the cost of a given string, then you can efficiently evolve according to the Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't require having to evaluate the function for all the values.
No.
First place?
No. If you want, we can maybe talk about it more later.
No, I just want
to. I actually just say something briefly. So I distributed these various questions that we can discuss this afternoon. You can get a copy of this to make sure that it would involve the bills we have. I mean, one question that I've had for a long time, and everybody for this, you know, for the Kroger search algorithm, you have your cross function be 0 and 1. But to solve the problem, for the final Hamiltonian to solve the problem, it's only necessary that it be 0 on the state you're looking for. You could change the cost function to make it anything else on the state you're not looking for. So the question is, is there a way of finding a distribution from the things that you know or believe are polynomial so that you could get the same behavior for a search algorithm? And I don't think that contradicts the square root theorems, because you'd be effectively using a very different kind of oracle to change the cost function. Anyhow, that was problem 5 on the questions I raised, and I just wanted to point it out while we had the things. I had some more questions, but I think we should probably break and save questions for discussion and also the formal discussion this afternoon.